Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hi there, I'm Carla Nappi, and this is New Books in Science, Technology, and Society. Welcome, and thank you so much for joining us. I just spoke with Nathaniel Comfort about his recent book, The Science of Human Perfection, How Genes Became the Heart of American Medicine. This was published in 2012 by Yale University Press. This is a book that is an extraordinary pleasure to read. It's written in a style that's very lively, it's very vibrant, and it puts the transformations, the actions, the decisions, the evolution, the relationships of human beings right at the center of the story. The story traces the emergence and really fundamental intertwining of two threads of the history of science and medicine that most people tend to keep separate, or at least think of as, if not qualitatively different types of endeavor, then at least totally different in terms of value. These two threads are medical genetics and eugenics. Nathaniel shows over the course of the story the ways in which these, what we might think of as two realms, medical genetics and eugenics, were actually not just intertwined throughout the 20th century, certainly in the context of America and American scientists and doctors, but also in a way mutually defined each other. He also shows that the kinds of value judgments that we typically bring to understanding and writing about, thinking about medical genetics on the one hand and eugenics on the other, namely medical genetics good, eugenics bad, are actually very, very simplistic and in fact inaccurate if we look at the history of the kinds of practices and the kinds of endeavors and goals that were at the root of both of these endeavors. And so it's a story that by tracing the actions and the works and the transformations and technologies and spaces of American sciences and doctors over the course of the history of these practices really helps show how ultimately medical genetics isn't all, as I say later on in the conversation, unicorns and rainbows, and eugenics wasn't all this horrible, bad, negative set of practices that we associate with that endeavor. You'll hear, in addition to getting an overview of the book and its really wonderful narrative over the course of the conversation, you'll also hear an account of Nathaniel's own interest in and really fascinating approach to writing a historical account. And so toward the beginning of the interview, I urge you to listen in for his comments on the ways that he approaches the craft of the historian in terms of his own background and thinking really carefully about writing from the perspective of how it's going to be read and thinking about things like character and structure and the kinds of elements of a historical narrative that we often associate more with fiction and fiction writing craft than with history writing craft, even though we should, I think, be taking much more time to think about this as writing historians. So it was a really fascinating book. It was really a pleasure to talk with Nathaniel about this, and I hope you enjoy the interview as much as I did. We're here today to talk with Nathaniel Comfort about his recent book, The Science of Human Perfection, How Genes Became the Heart of American Medicine. Welcome to New Books in Science, Technology, and Society, Nathaniel, and thank you so much for making the time to talk with me today.
You're welcome. Thank you. It's a pleasure.
For me too. So could you start us off, as is traditional for NBSTS, to talk a little bit about yourself and your background? What brought you to the field of the history of modern biology and medicine in the first place?
I would say probably a lot of people in the field, I came to it through a kind of a zigzagging path, not to say a checkered career, but I started out in biology. I majored in marine biology, and then I went on to a graduate program where I studied neurobiology and animal behavior. And I got to do some fun field work in South America and so on. But the laboratory work in that particular specialty was really not my cup of tea, and I decided that I liked, although I loved the idea, the ideas of biology, I wasn't really cut out for a life in a lab, and so I wanted to write about the science so I could stay immersed in it, but really words were my métier. So I thought there were two basic kinds of approaches to writing about science journalism and the history of science. And so I ended up actually doing both of those, and my work today still, I still consider that I kind of have one foot in science journalism while doing, you know, serious scholarly work in the history of science and medicine. So I started out actually working, I was the science writer at Cold Spring Harbor Laboratory for 5 years. Yeah. And so I worked for, you know, I was James Watson's writer, and I got to meet some of the famous scientists there and hang out in the bar with the researchers and so on. And I really, really enjoyed that. And it was while at Cold Spring Harbor that I decided to go back for my PhD in the history of science. And that's how I ended up doing my dissertation and my first book on Barbara McClintock, who was a scientist there.
Wow, that's actually really interesting to hear also, because one of the things, and I know I've mentioned this to you briefly, I think, when we were setting up the interview, but I'll also mention it for the benefit of listeners, and perhaps especially for listeners who haven't yet had a chance to read the book, that it's extraordinarily well written. It's just, it's one of the clearest, most vibrant examples of academic prose that I've had the good fortune to come across and to read in a long while. And so it seems like it's the background in science journalism actually probably really helps with that.
Well, thank you very much. I think it does. It's, I think a lot about the writing, and, I do try to make it lively and clear, and use, I borrow some techniques from creative nonfiction and even from fiction. I'm used to writing for an audience that doesn't have specialized knowledge about my very specialized topics. That is partly where that comes from.
So super briefly, because you just mentioned that you borrow techniques from creative nonfiction and from fiction, and because this is one of the big pieces of advice that I often give graduate students in academic disciplines and people who ask me what I use when I write, I actually read a lot of books on implotment and on other kinds of characteristics of writing fiction that are meant for fiction writers, but that I feel like actually help a lot for those of us writing history. So what are some of the, even just like a couple or few techniques that you're drawing from, or resources you're drawing from creative nonfiction and from fiction writing, that shape the way you sit down and write a book like this?
Well, I would highlight, I could go on at length for this, but on this topic, it's one of my favorite questions. But let me just mention two: character and structure. Okay, characters. People are sort of out of fashion in scholarship nowadays. It's sort of remarkable to me. But I always try to have people in my stories. History is a kind of story. It's a true story. So it's a very special kind of story, but it's a story. And I'm always trying to tell stories that have real live human beings in them. So I love character driven fiction. And I read a lot about that. And I read, you know, I pay attention to how characters are introduced and how you bring in different sensory modalities and so forth to make a narrative come alive. And the second, you know, is structure. I pay a lot of attention to the structure of everything I write, even if it's only a 600 word book review, and certainly at the level of articles, chapters, and books, I think about how I'm going to organize the piece, and I have some kind of outline, and it may not be a traditional linear, you know, A1, B2 kind of outline. It could be anything. And so, for example, there's a series, two or three articles by the nonfiction writer John McPhee that appeared in the New Yorker. The latest one just appeared a few weeks ago, and they're on structure. And McPhee is one of my idols in writing. And these are really kind of nerdy technical articles about how he organizes his, you know, how he develops structure. He's one of the masters of structure. And he goes through it in great detail. And I was just riveted reading these things because, I knew that he was interested in structure, and I map out McPhee's works. You know, I think I try to figure out what is the structure that he's using in his writing. And I was just tickled to see that a lot of my intuitions about how he worked were basically right. So I would commend those articles by McPhee on structure in the New Yorker to any reader who's interested in how you put together a narrative.
I've seen those articles. I think in at least one of them that I've seen, he includes actual maps or visual diagrams in some.
Yeah.
Right. It's, you know, those are fun.
That's right.
In fact, I'm gonna include links to those when I post this, so that
wonderful.
Can see. Yeah, this is great advice.
Yeah. You know, his outlines could be a spiral, you know, or three different arrows pointing to one another, or a wandering line. They're not traditional outlines a lot of times at all, and that really frees up the writer to think creatively about how to put together a story.
So the particular story that we have at hand to talk about has brought you from Barbara McClintock in your first book in your dissertation to Jim Watson and Cold Spring Harbor and a bunch of other really fascinating characters in this study of the relationship and or relationships between medical genetics, that's right, and eugenics in its various different instantiations. So this is a great story, and you've already talked a little bit about your own background working with some of the protagonists or actors or characters in this book prior to deciding, I guess, to sit down and write it as a narrative. But what in particular brought you to this project and to the decision to write this book after writing the McClintock book and as part of your larger research trajectory?
So there's a very specific story. I remember the exact moment I decided to write a book on the history of American medical genetics. And it was when I was, it was shortly after the McClintock book came out. So it was about 2001 or possibly the first part of 2002. And, that long ago. And I was giving a talk at Johns Hopkins, and I wasn't yet on the faculty here. I was still at George Washington University, and I was invited to give a talk in one of the science departments at the medical school. And on my, and I knew that one of the You know, one of the giants of Johns Hopkins medicine was Barton Childs. He was in his 80s at that time, very senior and very distinguished person, and I just wanted to meet with him. So I got him put on, I requested a meeting with him as part of my, you know, as part of my day at Hopkins. And by the time I got to meet him, and we went out for coffee and we sat and talked, and it just went all over the place, and I found him a riveting character. And by the time I got back from that meeting, I knew what my next book was going to be. I didn't know exactly what shape it was going to take or what I was going to say about it, but I knew that I wanted to know more about Childs and more about medical genetics. And I realized, okay, you know, there is a story here and there's not much written on it. And this is what I want to do.
So you start us off in the preface explaining this book as a history of promises, which is, I think, a really wonderful way of framing the entire thing. I've already mentioned that the book traces a history of the relationship between medical genetics and eugenics. And you mentioned early on, and now I'll just say a few things just to kind of set up the basic premises of the book for listeners. You say early on that medical genetics or heredity stemmed from two major impulses: an impulse toward the relief of suffering and an impulse toward human improvement. Now, rather than treating eugenics in the book as a, quote, contaminant of good, honest biomedicine, the book actually reframes what we think of when we think about eugenics and its history as ultimately being about, like medical genetics, human improvement and the relief of suffering. So to do this, what the book does is follow a group of American scientists and medical practitioners, doctors, through various stages of the 20th century, from the emergence of Mendelian genetics all the way through to, by the end of the book, we're in the Human Genome Project. There are two major subversive aspects of this account that you're giving us, and these are just two major subversive elements of the story, and there are many other ways in which this story really, I think, very productively upends what we think we know about the history of medicine and eugenics as a concept in its history. So you both at the same time trace this medical thread through early human genetics, which really does the work of kind of positioning the period as less, and using a quote here, confused and malicious than it's been depicted in the past. I mean, a lot of us think of eugenics and we think bad, right? We think eugenics equals horrible. And this is not the work that the book is doing. And it's actually really, really interesting because of that. And at the same time, and conversely, genetic medicine actually comes to be seen as actually also more complicated and not as wholly wonderful and shiny and unicorns and rainbows as it has typically been. Okay, so just to get that out of the way so that listeners know what we're talking about, unicorns and rainbows. So the book, as we move into the chapters of the book is founded on a bunch of really fascinating kinds of research. And one of the kinds of research that you single out right at the beginning is oral interviews. And I know that you're also involved, as is Sally Smith Hughes, who we interviewed for the channel a little while ago, in the Oral History of Human Genetics Project. So oral interviews seem to be really at the foundation of the kind of work that you were doing for the book. I wonder if you could talk about that a little bit. What was the what was the scope of the interviews that you were doing? How foundational was that in shaping the structure of the story as it emerged for you? And was there anything notable about that process that you'd want to share as it pertains to the research for this book in particular?
Yeah, sure. The oral histories are important. And again, that comes back to, I think, has roots in my training in science writing and journalism. Oral history interviewing as a scholarly methodology is different from interviewing as a journalist, but there is some overlap, and I'm really fascinated by how we use oral testimony as a scholarly source, as primary sources. Fairly early on into this project, must have been about 2003, 2004, I received a note from a woman out at UCLA named Marsha Meldrum. She and I were graduate students together. We had the same advisor, Ruth Schwartz Cowan, and so we knew each other a bit. She was a few years ahead of me, but we knew each other. And she asked me if I wanted to be part of an oral history of human genetics project that she was starting up. And I said, yes, that sounds like it would fit very nicely with my new research project. So I was, there are several interviewers involved on the project at various times, including graduate students of mine and folks out at UCLA. And we interviewed, we've got well over 200 hours of interview material with 40 plus scientists, as well as technicians and clinicians and so forth, but it's focused mainly on the basic both basic research, clinical research, and to some extent bioethics and genetic counseling. And we were doing, these were multi-session life history interviews, 5 to 7 hours in length usually. And so they covered a lot of aspects. They weren't all just focused on my particular research project, but those were a very important source for me in figuring out how to frame this story. I knew I wanted to work on the history of medical genetics, but I didn't know that. But then the question was, what's the story there, right? This wasn't going to be just a chronology, but I needed to have an argument. And talking to a lot of medical geneticists really helped me figure out what the stories were, what the story was in the history of American medical genetics. And I kept, the main thing that came through to me that formed the core ended up forming the core of the book was the way in which ideas kept coming out that reminded me of approaches that were used by progressive era eugenicists. I'd done a fair amount of reading on the history of eugenics. It was part of my graduate work and early scholarship. And I was talking to people who I liked and respected and whose work I admired, and they kept bringing up ideas that connected back to the history of eugenics. And these were not, evil people by any means, right? So I had to wrestle with that and say, okay, but I thought eugenics was bad, and here were people saying things like we need to find out how to use genetic knowledge to eliminate human disease, to keep people from being born who would be suffering, to reduce suffering on parents and so forth. And I had to figure out how to make that make sense with the fact that these were distinguished, honorable, nice people. Yeah. And I think that's really what lies at the core of the book.
Again, history is made of people, right?
Exactly.
Yeah. So how do we get from there into the core of the book? Well, the book opens up in chapter one with four scientists starting a journal club in 1950. And you talk about how significant this was for the time. This journal club was called the Galton-Garrod Society. And I'm sorry if I'm mispronouncing any of these names. And so I'm sure you'll correct me and say the correct pronunciation if I'm wrong. But I'm going to say the Galton-Garrod Society. The book uses Galton and Garrod to represent the two forces or a pair of forces that have helped shape medical genetics over the 20th century. And so these are really This sets up a pair that is going to continue reverberating throughout till the very last part of the book. And so let's talk about them briefly, especially for listeners who may not be familiar with one or both of them. So most readers and listeners are probably going to be familiar with, or at least have heard of, Francis Galton. This was the cousin of Charles Darwin. He coined the term eugenics. And he was, among other things that you mentioned in the book, the inventor or developer of a gumption reviver, which was one of my favorite moments in the book. And I'll just leave that out there tantalizingly, so listeners will have to read the book to see what this gumption reviver machine was. And then there was Archibald Garrett, which listeners and readers may be less familiar with. He was a younger contemporary of Galton, and he was actually a pediatrician interested in biochemistry who worked on, among other things, a condition called alkaptonuria, which is a condition that darkens urine. So can you talk a little bit about what's the distinction between these two guys in terms of the larger arguments that are being made in the book, and what's important about their different approaches to heredity?
Okay. So first of all, the reason I use that anecdote to open the story is because that lets me, because they are actors categories, right? These are figures who are held up by some of the contemporary figures who are my characters in the story. And so, you know, I'm using them as emblems of the ways in which medical geneticists construct the history of their own field. And then I try to complicate that by pulling out implications of both of these two people. So I use them as emblems of two major strands in the history. And then, but it, you know, when, you know, as a scholar, when I look more closely at these figures, the aspects of their work and their ideas came out that complicated that story of these actors categories and allowed me to nuance it and step back and not just celebrate the ways in which, you know, the sort of, not just celebrate the master narrative of medical genetics, but to contextualize it and complicate it. So with that, Galton, and so I use them to symbolize a number of not really binaries, but axes, you know, continua or spectra that I see, you know, as helping us understand how medical genetics developed. Galton stands for, as you pointed out, he's well known as the father of eugenics. He was also one of the inventors of biostatistics. He invented the technique of linear regression and one of the earliest descriptions of correlation and many other techniques. So he stands for a scientific approach. He was interested. He's commonly associated with the bell curve, a population approach to human qualities or any aspect of nature. So he used scientific methodology, and so statistical, population based, and he thought that truth in nature was often masked by noise, by variation, and so forth. So his techniques were often involved ways of trying to strip away the noise that obscured the real trends and real patterns in nature. And that's where the bell curve comes in. Also, another aspect of Galton's work, obviously, is human improvement. The desire to take a rational approach to solving social problems, a scientific approach, using science to solve social problems. Okay, Garrett is sort of his counterpart. He was trained as you say, as a pediatrician. He was a medical man, and where Galton is interested in the population and in stripping away away variation as noise, Garrod was interested in the individual. As a pediatrician, he was trying to find out why this patient has this disease now. And so he thought that looking precisely at variation was the way to find out what was really going on with human nature. So his approach was individual and personal and medical, in contrast to Galton's more scientific approach. And he had no interest in eugenics or improvement of the species in the long term. He was interested in this patient right now. And those, you know, we often have told the story of the emergence of medical genetics as, you know, it's been widely associated with, you know, widely documented that there's a connection between early human genetics and eugenics. But the story is usually told as human genetics getting tangled up with eugenics as a kind of a contaminant or a pseudoscience or something, and then moving beyond that by mid-century, stripping away the eugenic component and moving into a legitimate medical science. So there's a medical turn going away from eugenic concerns with intelligence and the population and feeble-mindedness as the great bugbear and a medical turn leading to a kind of a rationalized, medicalized human genetics. And I tell a different story in which I show that those two aspects, those two strands, were present right from the beginning and continue all the way to the present day.
Now, once we set up that as a foundation in the first chapter, you bring us into a new set of characters in this elaboration of the story of how medicine becomes genetic and becomes really an integral part of the history of eugenics and vice versa. So chapter 2 opens with Irving Fisher kissing his wife goodbye and leaving to seek treatment for tuberculosis. Along the way, this guy who you describe as disciplined, almost totally humorless, he doesn't have caffeine, he doesn't consume alcohol, pepper, or tobacco, he meets up with John Harvey Kellogg, who listeners and readers might be familiar with for other reasons outside of the history of genetics and eugenics and these kinds of issues. He goes to stay in Kellogg's sanitarium. And along the way, they develop this relationship that really transforms the way Fisher thinks about the issues that he's thinking about and really helps make him a leading figure in the progressive era health reform movement and in early efforts to nationalize healthcare. So would you talk a little bit about what's happening with Fisher and Kellogg in this part of the book and how this relates to this kind of direction that eugenics takes in its association with hygiene in this period?
Right. That story is really about the public health roots of eugenics in America. The history of American eugenics has been dominated, scholarship on American eugenics has been dominated by an association that's been around for, you know, scholars have been writing about this for more than 20 years, by the connection between American eugenics and agriculture. Eugenics was defined by Charles Davenport at one point, the sort of dean of American eugenics, as the science of human improvement through better breeding. And we've been, you know, really kind of obsessed with the idea of eugenics as being a sort of, you know, horse breeding applied to humans, right? And that's there. I don't deny that's there. But there's another dimension in which eugenicists were also very interested in public health. A public health connection with eugenics has been shown in the scholarship on eugenics in other countries, for example, in France and to some extent Scandinavia. But that hasn't been part of the narrative of American eugenics. And I show that in fact was very strong. And Fisher was a great way for me to tell that story as the sort of centerpiece of a, of a, of this narrative. He's the he receives almost no attention in the scholarship on American eugenics. He's hardly present at all. But he was a major figure. He was the founder of the American Eugenics Society in 1921, and so you know he deserves, I think, to be explored. And yeah, you bring up the story about his tuberculosis, and so it shows how he got into eugenics, not even concerned with what we think of as hereditary disease, but rather with an infectious disease. So what does eugenics have to do with infectious disease? Physicians dating back to the late 19th century had been interested in infectious disease as a and particularly in predisposition to infectious disease such as tuberculosis, and that so that had been part of a big debate going back many decades already by this time, and eugenicists were fascinated by the idea of predisposition to disease. And that, of course, is a major focus of genetics and genomics today. So, you know, this shows that this goes back quite far. Kellogg and his sanitarium, he was one of the most colorful figures in American public health during the Progressive Era. This is the same Kellogg as in Kellogg's Corn Flakes and the Breakfast Cereal King. A lot of that work was actually done by William Harvey's brother. They had a major and highly publicized feud, and they William Keith got the cornflakes patent, and John Harvey got the sanitarium. And there's a wonderful, very funny comic novel about this by the author T.C. Boyle, which The Road to Wellville, which I greatly enjoy. Kellogg was an avid eugenicist. He thought, you know, what's a public health guy who's interested in mainly in things like yogurt enemas? What's he doing worrying about genetics and heredity? He saw that as he was a kind of a holistic practitioner. And so he thought that one's constitution, one's heredity, was an essential part of one's health. And Fisher was very sympathetic to this idea. And it was Kellogg who got Fisher interested in heredity. Fisher went on to become a major champion of public health and ideas of heredity. And it was, I detail in the book a number of his projects, and show how they all built up to his, you know, what he considered his crowning achievement in this field, which was the founding of the American Eugenics Society. Fisher wasn't, by the way, a geneticist or even a scientist. He was an economist at Yale, and he was very well known in that field, but so this was kind of almost a side project for him. It was something that he did really out of passion. But that also shows that there's a social science dimension to eugenics that also helps complicate our conception of the history.
Yeah, thank you so much. Now, at some point in that chapter also, and I don't want to ask you to talk about this just so that we can move on to some of the other fascinating characters and developments here, but I will just mention for listeners who are interested, this chapter introduces one of many cases throughout the book in which we see physical meetings of people, so conferences in particular, being important historiographical sites and spaces. And so I just wanted to mention that because from the perspective of the craft of the history of science and medicine, it's actually a really important kind of case to model. And I think it's really interesting to look at conferences actually as these like sites of foment and sites of transformation. And So that was a really interesting also part of that chapter and part of, I think, many other chapters later on in the book as well.
I agree. Thanks. Yeah.
So as we move into the book, into chapter 3 and chapter 4, I won't ask you to talk about chapter 3, but I'll just say a little bit about what's going on, and then we'll move on to chapter 4. So chapter 3 is fascinating in terms of looking at the people involved in the story as well. It opens with an account of a letter by a country doctor from North Carolina named William Allen. And what this chapter does is it sets up sort of two ways of thinking about or two approaches toward academic genetics, which really shows this point of transformation where academic genetics becomes integrated with medicine thanks to a few pioneers like this country doctor, William Allen. And you set out here these two different approaches, one of which takes heredity as constitutional, as part of the soil. And this is mainly done by Girardian's holists and synthesizers who are interested in bringing together concerns with heredity, with broader and broader areas of knowledge, and with broader kinds of thinking about heredity, and versus approaches to genes as the seeds of disease. And you talk in that case also, and this is why I just wanted to mention this, about the emergence of blood group genetics in the 1920s. And so readers and listeners who are interested in the history of medicine and in how the development of something that we take right now as to be as fundamental as blood groups really is a very important part of this story and part of this set of threads that are constantly interwoven throughout this story of medical genetics and eugenics. So I just wanted to kind of set that up. And if there's anything in there in particular that you want to talk about, we can do that in a moment. But because we just talked a little bit about conferences as important sites or spaces of this story, we talked a little bit about Kellogg Sanitarium as an important space. Chapter 4 really also opens up this idea of the spaces of this history. This is a chapter that opens with the demise of the Eugenics Record Office in 1939. And the Eugenics Record Office was established by someone who you mentioned before, Charles Davenport. And you talk here about the creation of a new kind of institution called the Heredity Clinic. So would you talk a little bit about what is the importance of what's happening at the Heredity Clinic, and how does that integrate with the larger kind of argument or set of arguments that you're making in this part of the book?
Okay, the Heredity Clinics were fascinating. They were started, as you mentioned, just months after the demise of the Eugenics Record Office, at the end of 1939. And the 1940s and early 50s are a kind of a dark ages in the history of eugenics and human genetics. Most scholars have turned their gaze to England and Europe when looking at this period. And so, you know, any place not a lot of attention certainly makes me want to dig in there and say, okay, something must have been going on. And in fact, a lot was going on. And the Heredity Clinics are, in the conventional narrative of eugenics and human genetics, you have this eugenic period that ends in the 30s. And then nothing much happens. And then when you look back in the 1950s again, out pops modern medical human genetics. And the Heredity Clinics are really the missing link between those. They're I call them hybrid institutions because they were explicitly founded on the model of the Eugenics Record Office. In one case, they even borrowed their stationery. So then they were very interested in long-term goals of human improvement, in the permanent elimination of disease, in the improved public health, genetic public health, and genetic preventive medicine. But they also show signs of aspects, characters that we associate with modern medical genetics. They were doing good, rigorous, controlled studies. They were trying to identify new human genes for disease. They invented genetic counseling, and so the fascinating thing about them, and there were three major ones that I cover in the book. One at Wake Forest University, which was the one that William Allen started, and then at the University of Michigan, the best known person there was James Neal, who's a legendary figure in human genetics, and then also the Deit Institute for Human Genetics in Minnesota. And they were all started about the same time, 1941, 42, and they all knew each other. It was a very small world, and people were moving back and forth between them and so forth. So they really, it really makes sense to look at them as a kind of a multivalent unit. And I found it fascinating to really dig into how they practiced their version of medical genetics. And each one had a little bit different character. Wake Forest focused more on the medical side of things, and the folks at Michigan were doing more scientific. And I bring in the themes of Garrodian and Galtonian approaches that we talked about earlier. And really show how there isn't a firm dividing line between eugenics and medical genetics. They were seen as really two aspects of the same thing. In fact, medical genetics was eugenics. That was the only reason for bringing genetics into medicine at that time, which is one of the important points in chapter 3. Eugenics wasn't an obstacle to genetics entering medicine. It was the only reason that genetics was brought into medicine in the first place. And the reason for that is that it enabled you to do prevention. You couldn't do anything about most hereditary disease. Once somebody had the disease, there was very little you could do to treat it. There were a few cases where you could palliate or you know, bring in some environmental treatments. But for the most part, they recognized that the only thing you could do clinically about genetic disease was prevent it. And that meant at that time, restricting people's mating habits. Okay, and so eugenics was essential. It was integral to the development of what we consider modern medical genetics.
So after we look at these spaces, and it's a very, very rich chapter, again, that sets out, I think, some of the complexities that are bound up with eugenics as potentially very different kinds of things in different spaces in this period, we move to how the geneticists learn to start worrying and love mutation, which is obviously a play on the title of a rather famous movie, or the subtitle of a rather famous movie that listeners will be, I'm sure many will be familiar with. So there's so much in this chapter I could ask you about, and what I'm going to do is restrict myself to asking you about one sentence. Because this is okay. one of the most powerful sentences in this chapter. You say, the atomic bomb was the best thing that had ever happened to human genetics. So that's a quotation. So I think the best approach to this chapter is just to, can you talk about that a little bit? So how is the atomic bomb, how did this transform, or what are some of the most important ways that this transformed human genetics? And would you talk about that in the context of the work this chapter is doing?
Yeah, sure. The one word answer is mutation. Okay, human genetics was, as we talked about a little bit before, in the progressive era, was heavily focused on really complex diseases, what we would call today complex genetic disease, which is non-Mendelian, right? Disease that involves multiple genes and as well as environmental factors, and you know those were conditions that were most important to that were socially relevant diseases that a lot of people were dying from, you know, tuberculosis and cholera and so forth. And so there were only a handful of simple Mendelian genes known in humans that had been documented. But of course, those are the kinds of diseases that you can do the most rigorous science on, especially given the knowledge of the day. And what the atomic bomb did was to highlight for the general public the threats of mutation. And so it brought genetics, human genetics, onto the national stage. So I talk about, one of the figures in this chapter is Hermann Joseph Müller, who won the Nobel Prize in 1927 for his work on Drosophila genetics, where he demonstrated the X-ray induced mutation in fruit flies. And this will be well known to historians of genetics, he had been interested in eugenics for a very long time. He had a popular book called Out of the Night, in which he talked about the dangers of mutation, but it didn't get a whole lot of traction because it wasn't a huge threat. He was mostly talking about things like background radiation and medical X-rays and the X-ray machines used by shoe salesmen to measure your feet and so forth. And when in the immediate aftermath of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, mutation became a huge social issue. And so within months of the dropping of the bombs, Müller was refashioning his 20-year-old arguments about the dangers of mutation in light of this enormous new national global threat. And with that, he really did get some traction, and he quickly became one of the leading national spokesman about the dangers of atomic radiation to our genes, the impact on our DNA. And one of the centerpieces of this chapter is the formation of the American Society of Human Genetics, which was founded in 1948. And I show how the early history of the social history of the atomic bomb, the atomic age, was integral to the founding of this first professional society of human genetics. Müller was made the first president of the society, and in his presidential lecture, Our Load of Mutations, he made the case for why you need a professional society of human genetics right now. And the reason was that the threat of mutation was so great that we needed a humane eugenic program in order to offset the dangers of atomic radiation.
Right. And so thank you so much. And so also over the course of this chapter, as we sort of move into the other chapters, we see some really interesting and really important transformations in how eugenics is understood. And so you show a couple things here that I just want to mention for listeners because they seem really important to the arguments here. You're showing that practices that had long been associated with negative eugenics actually come to be seen here as relatively benevolent or relatively benign as they start to be considered medical rather than being, associated with building a master race. So what eugenics is actually transformed. And you're also, especially for people who are interested in the history of public health and the history of medicine, you're showing in this chapter how sterilization and birth control as medical practices, as eugenic practices, actually helped shift the objects of eugenicists from populations to individuals. And that becomes a really important part of what's going to happen in the next chapters as well. So as we move, because I would love to take up 2 hours of your time because it's really fascinating, but I promise not to do that. And so as we move toward the last couple of chapters of the book, I'll just kind of summarize a little bit about what's going on in chapter 6 and sort of bring us forward, just to put some things on the table. So chapter six focuses on one of the people who we met at the very beginning of the first chapter who founded this journal group, and this is Victor McCusick. Now, he, you show in this chapter at the beginning that he becomes known as the father of medical genetics, according to his Johns Hopkins obituary. And you show in here, actually, that calling him the father of this field is actually kind of a misnomer because the field predated him. But he becomes really important and really influential, not because he's making all these medical or scientific discoveries, but because he becomes really savvy as a gatekeeper to the field, as a kind of broker of knowledge and of its tools. During the late 50s and 60s also, you're showing here how genetics becomes established as a medical specialty, and in part that's made possible because of a couple of really low-tech, or a few, four you mentioned here, really low-tech developments that may seem to us to be kind of, you know, what do you mean that's transformative, but actually really transformed the kind of knowledge that was possible of human heredity. So included in these four items, I'll just single out two, which are really striking. A researcher figures out how to add deionized water instead of saline to his culture medium. And this is actually really important because when you add deionized water instead of salt, the cells swell up, spreading out the chromosomes in the nucleus and making them easier to see. And also somebody figures out that rather than fixing, embedding, and slicing materials into to make slides to look at them under a microscope, if you just put a drop of medium on the slide, plop on a cover slip, and then just kind of squish it with your thumb, that works too. And this actually is better because it keeps more chromosomes intact and thus more countable. So this is a really fascinating part of the book in terms of the history of technology, as we see some really what we might think of as really low-tech solutions to problems having really transformative impacts on the way we understand human life. So this is a really fabulous part of the book. You're also showing here that the chapter, or the name of chapter six, is Getting Their Organ, and you're showing here how also cytogenetics actually gives geneticists an organ to work with and makes possible transformations in the field. And I'll leave that there.
If I could just jump in with one little kind of linkage on that, I'll be succinct. But so the emergence of the American Society of Human Genetics was key because that begins to professionalize the field, and that set the institutional basis for these technical developments that you're mentioning here, and the link between the history of technology and Victor McCusick and the father of medical genetics. I just would want to point out that I'm not saying that epithet is undeserved, but rather that it's not predetermined. It was contingent, right? There could have been other people that you could rationally give that name to, and what I'm trying to show is how I've had a longstanding interest in how reputations get built in science, and then you accurately say that it was through not a single spectacular Nobel Prize winning discovery, but rather through kind of low status activities of gathering, cataloging information, disseminating it, teaching, and so forth. And so, there's a theme here of interest in the low tech, in the low status kinds of, what Kuhn would have called normal science, and how they can be really formative in the development of a major field.
Thank you. So this brings us to the final body chapter of the book, and this is Genetics Without Sex, and it brings us to one of the first people who we talked about in the course of this conversation, and one of the people who you mentioned is really starting your interest in this field, and that's James Watson. So this chapter opens with his memoir, accounts of his memoir, The Double Helix, and traces the story of James Watson through this chapter as someone who becomes an emblem of, at the same time, the extreme technical advances, the possibilities, and also the pitfalls, and in particular the ethical pitfalls of the molecularization of medical genetics. And so to kind of take us into the conclusion of this book, or this last chapter of the book, can you talk a little bit about Jim Watson and this story? Sort of what is his trajectory here? And why in particular, this is sort of related, but it's also a separate issue in this chapter, or an independent issue in this chapter. How does sex become the sticking point of genetics? And how does a way to think about and work with sex as a process for these geneticists transform what's possible in this chapter?
Yeah, So sex was always as you say, a sticking point for human genetics back in the eugenic days. Given a desire to prevent genetic disease, as we said, there was nothing you could do in most cases to treat genetic disease. All you could do was prevent it, and so that's what I see as one of the origins of our focus on preventive genetic medicine today. And in those days, the only way you could do it was through preventing people from marrying, right? So a lot of both the social history and the technical history of medical genetics can be seen as a series of ways of getting around that problem. And so I talk about a number of different ways that you can do that through developing methods of cell culture, where they borrowed from bacteriology and figured out ways of quote unquote mating just regular somatic cells in a dish, ways of getting into the body of the individual, so you didn't have to worry about individuals marrying, but if you could get down to the level of the genes themselves, then the vision was that you could fix genetic disease without having to worry about who's mating with whom, right? And so that's how we get down to the molecular level. And Watson is the lead character in this story because he is Mr. DNA. He's, as people who solved the structure of DNA in 1953. He went on to orient his entire career on making DNA DNA, as we understand it. So at the DNA level, and human genetics took a very long time to go molecular, by the way. Other fields of genetics went molecular long before human genetics or medical genetics. It didn't really happen until after the genetic code was deciphered in the 1960s. And then, by 1969, Victor McCusick, who we've talked about, proposed a biologist's moonshot, which was to identify and map all of the human genes. And so I look at how human genetics goes molecular, and because at the molecular level, to a first approximation, all organisms are alike, and you can the development of recombinant DNA techniques, genetic engineering, and so forth, gave biologists the ability to begin to cut and paste DNA, to pull out genes, to study them, and enabled them to dream about repairing genes and fixing genetic disease that way, which led to ideas such as gene therapy.
Great. Thank you so much. And so you're at the final part of the book, or in the final part of the book, in the epilogue. You, I won't ask you to talk too much about this, but I'll just mention for listeners By the end of the book, you've really taken this whole story and all of these characters and all of these interwoven threads and brought it back to the issues that I think started the book at the very beginning of the book, which is, you know, looking at the ways that genetic medicine has redefined the very concept of disease, has redefined individuals as patients. And also you look here finally at this interesting interplay between therapy versus enhancement, which comes up also in this last chapter we talked about, and remind us that the relief of suffering has always been a part of eugenics. And so as we started saying at the beginning of this conversation, and here we are nearing the end of this conversation, just really, really does a huge service in complicating what we think of when we think of genetics or medical genetics and when we think of eugenics and the value judgments that I think you bring to those categories. So, Nathaniel, we've taken up a lot of your time. There is a ton of stuff in the book that if I had another hour or two, I could have asked you about. It's an extraordinarily rich study. Is there anything in particular that we didn't have a chance to talk about, but that you'd like to mention for listeners, and perhaps especially for listeners who haven't had a chance to read the book?
Well, I guess I would just say the overarching impetus of the book is to highlight some of the ways in which genetic medicine is complicated, as you point out, because I think, you know, there's an awful lot of hype and celebration and so forth surrounding current genomics. You know, everybody's getting their genome screened and so forth, and personalized genetic medicine is a very big topic in the news a lot today, and lots of discussions abound of all the promises of genetic medicine. And I think, you know, I just would want to emphasize that I share the optimism for some of those promises. But I think there are also risks associated with it. And so, you know, my motivation is to highlight those risks along with the promises so that we can, you know, so that we can better avoid them and realize the promises without falling into the traps.
So now that the book is out, and congratulations on the book, as I've said before, it's a great book. What's next for you?
Well, I have a couple of projects working. One of the things I'm most interested in right now is personalized medicine. As I mentioned a moment ago, the idea of I'm collaborating with a colleague here at Hopkins in my department who's an early modernist. This is Gianna Pomata, and we're working together on a project on looking at individuality in medicine over the long view. And so I've been looking into some of the greater history of Archibald Garrett, by now a kind of a mythological character in the history of medical genetics, and looking at the role of the individual and what it means to look at why this patient has this disease at this time, and what it means to construct the notion of the individual in terms of his genes, because there's a kind of a doubling back there. You know, as one of the advantages that's often posed for genetic medicine is it allows us to tailor medical treatment to the individual, but the individual is increasingly defined in terms of his or her DNA. And again, the history of eugenics shows us that can be problematic, right? It's not inherently evil, but it carries some pretty big risks. And so one of the things I'm trying to do is to understand better how the individual is, how the construction of the individual in medicine has evolved over the last couple of centuries.
Fabulous. So best of luck with that project. And thank you again for making the time to talk with me today. It's really been a pleasure.
Yeah, it's been a lot of fun. Thank you.
You've been listening to New Books in Science, Technology, and Society. Thanks very much for joining us, and we'll look forward to seeing you next time.